same with my friends. Many of them have read your work. Just being able to talk about shame helped so much. Dealing with my own issues of shame has helped me in areas of my life where I felt stuck. As a survivor myself, I've talked to my friends about shame relating to violence against women. But this book helped me identify other areas of shame in my life. The more common everyday areas that it was easy for me to ignore. Being able to talk about my shame, whether it is about my body, feeling too fat, or about my work, not being good enough, is so powerful. It took a lot of courage in the beginning to even bring up feelings of shame. I never want to talk about shame, but every time I do, I feel so relieved. The more I do it, the easier it gets. And usually I no longer feel ashamed. Without your work, I might not have been brave enough to speak. When I read these letters, the first thing that comes to mind is this. I didn't invent the strategies in this book. It's deeply meaningful to know that the ideas presented in this book are helping women, but these ideas belong to others besides just me. I listen to hundreds of women tell their stories and explain their strategies for dealing with shame. I studied their experiences, organized them, and put words to them. To better understand what I was hearing, I studied the work of many different clinicians and researchers. Their work, which is quoted throughout the book and referenced in the notes at the end, makes my work possible. Reading these letters only confirms what I've learned from studying relational cultural theory. We heal through our connections with others. Relational cultural theory grew out of a collaborative process of theory building initiated by the scholars at the Stone Center at Wellesley College. In their book, The Healing Connection, Jean Baker Miller and Irene Stiver wrote, "If we observe women's lives carefully without attempting to force our observations into pre-existing patterns, we discover that an inner sense of connection to others is the central organizing feature of women's development. By listening to the stories women tell about their lives and examining these stories seriously, we have found that, quite contrary to what one would expect based on the governing models of development emphasizing separation, women's sense of self and of worth is most often grounded in the ability to make and maintain relationships. The need for connection and the capacity to use these shame-resilient strategies is within all of us. And as Barbara points out in her letter, sometimes we're in the shame soup and need help. And other times, we are the ones who can throw the life preserver to the person who is drowning. There are certainly real differences that separate us all, in many ways, but in the end, we are more alike than we are different. We all need to feel valued, accepted, and affirmed. When we feel worthless, rejected, and unworthy of belonging, we feel shame. Long letters or short emails, letters from young women, or experienced professionals, it doesn't matter. The message is the same. One of the most important benefits of reaching out to others is learning that the experiences that make us feel the most alone are actually universal experiences. Regardless of who we are, how we were raised, or what we believe, all of us fight hidden, silent battles against not being good enough, not having enough, and not belonging enough. When we find the courage to share our experiences and the compassion to hear others tell their stories, we force shame out of hiding and end the silence. Here's how three women turned their shame experiences into connection. I got pregnant when I was 16. I always had weird periods, so I didn't even know until I was about 3 months along. The only person who knew was my sister. I didn't even tell my boyfriend. About a week after I found out, I had a miscarriage. It was really scary. My sister took me back to the doctor. On the way home from the doctor's office, my sister said losing the baby was the best thing that could have ever happened. That was 25 years ago, and every year I still remember the day that would have been my baby's birthday. I knew that I was not allowed to be sad about it because I wasn't supposed to be pregnant. I'm ashamed that I got pregnant, but I'm also ashamed that I wasn't allowed to be sad. Now when I see someone who is ashamed to be sad, I tell them how important it is to tell someone and let it out. I tell my daughters, my my friends, my nieces, anyone who seems to be scared to grieve. Everyone has the right to grieve and be sad. My dad's wife is younger than I am, and my mom's new boyfriend has been married 6 times. My family is ridiculous. We're supposed to be comfortable with that, and that's supposed to be okay because all families are crazy. Well, that only works when you're around other people who also talk openly about their families being crazy. When you're around people who pretend their families are perfect, it's not okay. In fact, it's very shameful because they judge you based on your crazy family members. You try to avoid the discussion and start talking about something else. When I see people admit something about their weird family and someone starts judging them and saying shitty things, I jump right in. I start talking about my family. If we all told the truth, no one would feel like they were the only one with a screwed up family. I try to help people in that situation because I've been there. It's really lonely. I think not knowing the truth about something is really shameful, especially when you're growing up and you hear things or get that information. When I was growing up, I thought a tampon could make you pregnant, and if you masturbated, you would become a porn star. I don't even know how I learned these things, but for 1 year, I wouldn't use a tampon. When my friends asked me why I wore gross pads, I couldn't tell them, because I wasn't sure if the pregnancy thing was true. It's not like I could ask my parents. Finally, I saw a tampon in one of my babysitter's purses, and I asked her about it. She just laughed and told me everything about periods, sex, and guys. Parents have no idea what bad information does to kids. When young kids ask me questions, or even make references to bad information, I tell them everything they want to know. I try to save them the misery I experienced. When we don't reach out to others, we allow them to sit alone in their shame, feeding shame the secrecy and silence it craves. Just like we can't use shame to change people, we can't benefit from other people's shame. We can, however, benefit from shared empathy. We don't reach out to fix or save others. We reach out to help others by reinforcing their connection network and our own. This increases our resilience by sharing our story, creating change. When we don't reach out, we fuel our shame and create isolation by separating, insulating. One of the benefits of sharing our story is experiencing knowing laughter. I define knowing laughter as laughter that results from recognizing the universality of our shared experiences, both positive and negative. It embodies the relief and connection we experience when we realize the power of sharing our shame. Hopefully, if you laughed when you read the cookie story, you were laughing with me, not at me. That's knowing laughter. Knowing laughter is not the use of humor as self-deprecation or deflection. It's not the kind of painful laughter we sometimes hide behind. Knowing laughter is acknowledging the absurdity of the expectations that form the shame web and recognizing the irony of believing that we alone are trapped and entangled in that web. When I think of knowing laughter, I think of the incredible volume of work written by Irma Bombeck and the poignant humor of Kathy, the comic strip written by Kathy Geiswhite. Their creative work targeting motherhood and single life captures our vulnerabilities in a way that makes us laugh and feel normal. There is something moving, spiritual, and essential about sharing knowing laughter with people who understand our struggles. My favorite definition of laughter comes from the wonderful writer Anne Lamott. I once heard her describe laughter as a bubbly, effervescent form of holiness. Over the past several years, I've had the opportunity to work with some wonderful graduate students on this project. We spent many hours reading and analyzing interviews and discussing shame. I remember when the research team first started exploring the concept of knowing laughter. Intuitively, we knew laughing about shared shame experiences played a significant role in our meetings. But as we heard an increasing number of research participants talk about it, we were a little surprised. Finally, we realized that the universal language of laughter gave all of us a way to talk about shame, a concept that otherwise resists words and descriptions. Here's what Marky McMillan, one of the researchers, writes. Laughter is the evidence that the chokehold of shame has been loosened. Knowing laughter is the moment we feel proof that our shame has been transformed. Like empathy, it strips shame to the bone, robs it of its power, and forces it from the closet. When we reach out to others and share our stories, we increase our power and potential to create change. For most of us, reaching out to others results in tremendous individual change and inspires some still further to engage in collective change. Creating change. Believing that we truly do have the ability to create change in our lives may seem difficult or even impossible at first, but it is one of the most empowering steps along the path to developing resilience. When we talk about individual and collective change, it's important to realize that not all of us are going to engage in political action, advocacy, or even small group efforts. Some of us may create change by changing the way we interact with people or changing our relationships. Others may raise critical awareness with friends and family members. We need to find a method of change that moves and inspires us. Sometimes as individuals, our efforts vary depending upon the issue. There are some issues that motivate me to fully engage in collective action. There are other issues where I feel my strongest contribution is making personal changes. When we talk about ways to create change, I like to think of the 6 P's. Personal, pens, polls, participation, purchases, and protests. Whether we are trying to change something at our child's school, fighting to have offensive magazines removed from our local convenience store, trying to get better maternity leave at work, or struggling to change national policy, the 6 P's work. Personal. Even the most personal changes often have a powerful ripple effect through the lives of our families, friends, and colleagues. Jillian, for example, started monitoring the shows her children watch, and now limits her fashion magazine subscriptions. Sandra, the woman silenced by her husband's remarks, has returned to debating politics and religion with her brother-in-law. She's also passing down her parents' wonderful legacy of living out loud and proud, along with tools her daughters can use to effectively deal with the shaming that some people use to keep us quiet. Change can take many forms. There is nothing more inherently political than breaking through social community expectations so we can live our lives at our full potential and help others do the same. Practicing courage, compassion, and connection in the face of shame is a political act. Pens. Write a letter. Most organizational leaders and legislators will respond to letters, emails, or faxes. My friend and colleague, Anne Hilpig, lobbies for children's issues. She told me that U.S. Congress members need only 12 letters before they ask someone in their office to research the issue. I send emails all the time. If you see an advertisement that's incredibly offensive, email the company. The National Organization for Women sponsors Love Your Body Day. On their website, they collect offensive advertisements that promote appearance shame, teen smoking, and alcohol consumption. They have a ready-made petition form that you can pass around to your friends and send to companies. The petition reads, "Dear Marketing Director, we refuse to starve our bodies to fit into this year's fashions. We reject your idea of tobacco as a diet aid, and we denounce the diet industry for making us doubt our dignity. We won't be pushed up, squeezed into, reduced, flattened, straightened, or touched up. You will not map my face or my body for the perfect eyes, nose, neck, breast, tummy, hip, thigh, or butt. We will not be cut up like meat for your profit. We're beautiful just like we are. We know that cigarettes addict and kill. We know that starvation diets rob us of muscle tissue and brain power. We know that the images of women you place in magazines and on TV are offensive, harmful, dangerous, and disrespectful. These ads are an attack on women and girls. These ads are an affront to my intelligence. These ads are an assault on women's equality. Polls. Vote. Find out how candidates feel about the issues that affect your life and vote. Participation. Learn about the organizations that support your issues. Join them in the fight. Most organizations make it very easy to stay up to date on issues by emailing or faxing updates. They'll also help you speak out by offering pre-formatted emails and faxes. You just enter your zip code and send them right from the computer. It takes 2 minutes, and they make sure it gets to the right person. Purchases. The dollar is mightier than the sword. Stop buying from people who don't share your values. Marketing research shows that women are the decision makers in an estimated 85% of household buying decisions. Here's an example. About 2 years ago, Ellen and I went to our local video rental store to rent a couple of DVDs. I was reading the back of movie cases when Ellen tugged on my shirt and asked, "Are they princesses?" I looked down, and rather than seeing one of her regular picks, I saw three young women in string bikinis. The title of the movie was something like Want Ads, Trouble in the Suburbs. I grabbed it out of her hand and examined it cover to cover. It was an adult movie. I immediately picked up Ellen, power walked to the register, and asked to speak to a manager. After a couple minutes' wait, a young woman walked up to me and introduced herself. "When did you start carrying these?" I asked. She looked down at the box and sighed. "We got the porn about the same time they cut our benefits and extended our hours." She went on to explain that a huge telecommunications company had bought this national chain of video rental stores. After the buyout, they started renting adult movies. She explained that her store received only 50 adult movies, but the stores in poor neighborhoods stock hundreds of them. On the drive home, I explained to Ellen why I was angry and why I think some movies hurt girls and women. She helped me cut up my membership card. We mailed the shredded card and a letter to the company's district manager. I found a great online service that delivers DVDs straight to my door. No late charges and no adult movies. Our old store may never stop renting pornography, but Ellen and I are not participating. Protests. A protest is not always a million people marching on the Capitol. Sometimes a protest is 4 or 5 people showing up at a school board meeting or in someone's office. Regardless of size and scope, when we come together to ask for what we need, some people will label our actions as protest. If that stops us, we have to ask, who benefits by that? In The Dance of Intimacy, Harriet Lerner writes, "Although the connections are not always obvious, personal change is inseparable from social and political change." I believe this is true. Reaching out to others allows us to identify and name what we share in common, and creates the opportunity for both personal and social change. Barriers to reaching out. As we practice reaching out, we need to be very aware of the barriers that might get in the way. In the remainder of this chapter, we're going to examine the two main issues that often prevent us from practicing courage and compassion. The best way to introduce these concepts is by telling the story of Jennifer and Tiffany. Their story beautifully illustrates these barriers to reaching out and why it's worth the fight to overcome them. When I first interviewed Jennifer over the phone, she and her husband, Drew, were both finishing their MBAs, and they had a 3-year-old son, Toby. Our interview mostly focused on her struggle with speaking out in her predominantly male classes and the shame of sending her toddler to daycare while she worked and went to school every other weekend. I got to meet Jennifer in person several years later at a shame resilience workshop I was conducting. She approached me at a break and asked if she could share an important reaching out story with the group. This is her story. After finishing their degrees and getting jobs, Jennifer and Drew moved into their first house in their dream neighborhood. They moved in across the street from Tiffany and her husband, Andy. Jennifer and Tiffany both had sons the same age, and Tiffany had a baby daughter. Jennifer was pregnant at the time of our second interview. While their sons grew to be best friends, Jennifer and Tiffany's friendship moved a little slower. Jennifer told me, "Things never got very deep between us. It was mostly talk about kids. I tried a couple of times, but she just didn't seem to want to go there. After 1 year, I didn't know much about her, and she really didn't know much about me. Well, until this whole thing started." Jennifer explained that her younger sister, Carly, had struggled with alcoholism since her teens. Their mom, who was a recovering alcoholic, had called Jennifer to tell her that Carly had been admitted into a rehab hospital and that her mom would be caring for Carly's daughter, Emma, until Carly got out. Jennifer's mom asked her if she and Drew could attend family weekend at the rehab center, and Jennifer assured her that they would be there. Jennifer had never left her son with a sitter overnight, so she decided to ask Tiffany if her son could spend the night. Here's how Jennifer recalled the scene. "I walked across the street, knocked on the door, and took a deep breath. Tiffany answered the door, and I said, 'My sister Carly just went into rehab, and Drew and I need to go and see her in a couple of weeks. Could Toby spend one night with you? I'd ask my mom to drive down, but she'll be with my sister, too.'" Jennifer said that Tiffany looked shocked. Tiffany quickly answered, "Of course you can spend the night, no problem." Jennifer was relieved. Then Tiffany's question started. "Which sister? I thought you only had one sister." "Yeah, Carly, you met her a couple of months ago when she was here with her daughter. She lives upstate, close to my mom," answered Jennifer. Tiffany looked confused. "Carly? You're kidding! She's so cute, right? She was the one with the little girl. The two of them were wearing matching Lily Pulitzer dresses." "Yes, that's her," replied Jennifer, who was starting to get increasingly uncomfortable while Tiffany seemed to be trying to put it all together in her head. Here's how the rest of the conversation went. Tiffany: "She doesn't look like a person who goes to rehab. What's the problem?" Jennifer: "She's an alcoholic." Tiffany: "You're kidding. She doesn't look like an alcoholic. What does her husband think?" Jennifer: "She's not married." Tiffany: "You're kidding. What does your mother think?" Jennifer: "About her being an alcoholic or being a single mother?" Tiffany: "Gosh, I don't know." Jennifer: "She thinks Carly and Emma are great, and she's also a recovering alcoholic." Tiffany: "Wow, that's some family, very complicated." Jennifer: "Yes, I guess so. So Toby can stay with you that night?" As you can imagine, this conversation didn't do much to deepen the connection between Jennifer and Tiffany. And things would get worse before they got better. A couple of months later, Jennifer and Tiffany's boys started kindergarten. 2 weeks into school, there was a horrible incident in the carpool line. Jennifer had already picked her son up and was in the kitchen when Tiffany pounded on the door. Jennifer answered the door, and Tiffany excitedly reported every detail of the incident. "You are not going to believe this. Did you see the police cars? Did you see the ambulance?" Jennifer got scared. "No, what happened?" "One of the cars didn't pull forward in the carpool line, and people started honking. A mom got out of her car and walked up to the car that wasn't moving. A woman was slumped over the steering wheel. The mom started screaming, and a bunch of teachers ran up. They thought she was dead. Someone called 911, and by the time the ambulance got there, they realized that she wasn't dead. She was passed out drunk. Can you believe it?" Jennifer could barely respond. Her eyes welled up with tears. "Oh my God, that's horrible," she replied. Tiffany interrupted her. "I know. Can you believe? At our school? In our neighborhood? I mean, this woman could have killed someone. She could have run over our kids." "I know, I almost started crying too. Just thinking about that crazy woman driving up to our school like that?" Jennifer was speechless. Tiffany responded to her silence by saying, I know, I know. It's horrible. I'm devastated, too. It happened right here, down the street, in our neighborhood. Jennifer shook her head and said, I'm devastated for that mom, and her kids, and her family. But I don't think we're devastated for the same reasons, Tiffany. Tiffany, who was looking out the door, didn't respond to Jennifer's comment. She was distracted as she saw another neighbor pull up in the driveway and said, Oh, I'm going to talk to Lena about it. I'll see you later. Jennifer was angry and hurt. As she recounted the story, she kept telling me that she couldn't believe she could be friends with someone so superficial, so clueless. Tiffany knew that Jennifer's mother and sister were alcoholics, yet she failed to make the connection. Jennifer said, I'll never forget her saying that she couldn't believe that this could happen in our neighborhood, at our school, in front of our kids. Jennifer explained. I wanted to ask her, where do you think this should happen? Whose kids should see this? Their friendship became a little more distant, but this didn't stop Tiffany from asking Jennifer if she wanted to work together on the school's winter carnival. Tiffany pitched the idea by saying that it would be a great opportunity to get to know some of the PTA moms, especially Amber Daniels. Jennifer reluctantly agreed. She figured it would be a good way to ease some of her working mom guilt. Amber Daniels had three kids in the school, a fifth grader, a third grader, and a second grader. She was the president of the PTA and, according to Jennifer, about the most perfect person you'll ever meet. Jennifer described her as smart, beautiful, nice, and, by all accounts, a perfect mom. Tiffany idolized her to the point that she couldn't even talk to her. Amber had a following of friends, mostly the mothers of older kids. If Amber or any of her friends said hello to Tiffany, she stammered. Jennifer wasn't quite as starstruck, but did find this PTA in-crowd a little intimidating. Jennifer and Tiffany were put in charge of the silent auction. One evening, after a carnival planning meeting, Jennifer and Tiffany were walking out of the cafeteria when Amber, who was sitting with two of her friends, shouted, Hey, come join us for some coffee. Jennifer and Tiffany looked at each other and slowly started walking toward the table. Jennifer laughed and used her Valley Girl voice when she told me about the moment. She said, I kept thinking, Oh, my God, like, we've been invited to sit at the cheerleaders' table. They sat down, and Amber introduced herself and her friends. Then Amber asked, So, do either of you have exciting holiday plans? At this point in her story, Jennifer looked at me and said, Brene, honestly, I don't know what came over me. She went on to say, I looked right at Amber and said, Yeah, I'm going upstate to see my family. My sister just got out of rehab, so we're going to spend some time with her and her daughter. She's a single mom, and it's been hard. Apparently, Tiffany was so taken aback by Jennifer's candid answer that she slumped forward in her chair at the miniature cafeteria table, knocking her forehead against the table. Jennifer told us, If she was trying to divert attention from the conversation, she did a good job. Amber even asked her if she was okay. Tiffany pulled herself together, looked right at Jennifer, and said, Come on, Jennifer. I doubt Amber wants the details of your complicated family. Amber responded by laughing and saying, Hey, aren't all families complicated? Jennifer started to reply, but Tiffany interrupted and quickly said, Not like hers. At this point, Jennifer said she was starting to feel ashamed. She was staring down at her coffee cup, and was somewhat startled when Amber broke the awkward silence by asking, So, how's your sister doing? Jennifer described the moment like this. Amber was directing the question to me, but she was staring right at Tiffany with a look that said, You better not say a word. Jennifer quickly answered, Better, thanks. Where was she in treatment? Amber asked. Morewood? Jennifer replied. Amber nodded and said, Yeah, my husband sponsors a guy who went through their program. It's supposed to be pretty good. Tiffany was speechless. One of Amber's friends started laughing and asked, "What about you, Amber? Going to any holiday parties this year?" Amber and her friend started laughing, and Jennifer told me that she could sense that there was some kind of inside joke at work. Amber shook her head and said, "Talk about complicated." Amber went on to explain that the previous year they had taken their kids to her mom's house for the holiday. Amber's mother begged them to attend a holiday party hosted by one of her closest friends, who just happened to be the mother of Amber's first husband, her ex-mother-in-law. Jennifer told us that right in the middle of her story, Tiffany blurted out, "You've been married before?" Amber apparently nodded and just kept telling the story. Amber explained that all of her kids knew she had been married before, but she and her husband were shocked when her ex-husband showed up with his new boyfriend. Jennifer said, "By this point in the story, we were all laughing and getting on great, all of us except for Tiffany. She didn't even crack a smile." I almost felt bad for her, until she asked Amber if it was hard to expose her kids to the gay thing at such a young age. Jennifer said Amber handled it really well. She explained that she wasn't sure what Tiffany meant by the gay thing, but that her husband's youngest brother and his partner also lived in town and babysat the kids all the time, so the gay thing was a normal thing to their kids. Jennifer described the ride home from the carnival meeting as incredibly uncomfortable. Tiffany didn't say a word. About a week later, Jennifer asked Tiffany if they could talk. Tiffany agreed, and they talked about Carly, the carpool incident, and Amber. As hard as Jennifer tried to explain how she felt, Tiffany just kept saying, "I don't know why you talk about these things like you're proud of them." Jennifer said, "I tried to explain that I'm not proud of them, but I'm just not going to be ashamed of them. I tried to explain to her that I'm working on my shame issues, but she just didn't get it." Tiffany responded by saying, "Am I supposed to think more of Amber because her husband's an alcoholic with a gay brother and she's been married before? Well, I don't think more of her. I like honest people. When you see Amber, what you see is not what you get." Jennifer said, "I got so pissed, I gave up. I knew if it kept going, we'd end up not speaking." From that point, their relationship solely focused on the kids and school. Jennifer did become good friends with Amber. Tiffany remained convinced that Amber was overrated and turned down all of Jennifer's invitations to hang out with them. One morning, almost 6 months later, Tiffany called Jennifer. She was crying so hard that her voice was barely audible. Jennifer ran to Tiffany's house. The front door was open and Jennifer walked in. Tiffany was sitting on the kitchen floor, sobbing. "I was sure someone had died. I sat down next to her and asked her what had happened," Jennifer explained. Tiffany looked at Jennifer and said, "I'm not perfect. I'm really not. My life is as fucked up as everyone else's, I swear." Jennifer said, "I must have looked shocked," because Tiffany angrily said, "Yes, I said the F word. That's right. I'll say it again, too." Then she started sobbing even harder. Jennifer held Tiffany and said, "I know you're not perfect. Trust me, I know. It's fine. It's better than fine. It's great." They both laughed a little, but then Jennifer said that Tiffany turned toward her, held both of her hands, and reached out in the most powerful way. Tiffany explained to Jennifer that she really didn't understand. Tiffany explained that she didn't even know her father. She had never seen or met him. She told Jennifer that her mother didn't visit because Tiffany was too ashamed of her, so she didn't invite her. Tiffany said, "She doesn't have normal problems, like the kind you and Amber laugh about. She's poor. She's missing teeth. She doesn't speak like us. I didn't grow up in a neighborhood like this. No matter what I did growing up, no matter how good my grades were or how hard I worked to dress nice, I was still shit." When Tiffany met Andy at college, He was everything she wanted. He had the seemingly perfect family, and he taught her how to look good. Tiffany went on to tell Jennifer, "I didn't even invite my mom to my wedding. Andy met my mom after we were married. He didn't like her either. He hates where I'm from. It's not like I told him that I wasn't sure what to do about inviting my mom to the wedding, and he tried to talk me into inviting her. He said it would be easier on everyone if she didn't come." At this point, Jennifer and Tiffany were both crying. Tiffany told Jennifer, "I want to be normal, but I'm exhausted. I keep it all in because Andy would freak out if anyone knew our problems. I miss my mom. I don't know what to do. I want to be able to talk to you." Jennifer told me, "I didn't know what to say or do. I just sat and listened and cried." Jennifer said the hardest thing was when Tiffany stood up and walked over to a drawer in the kitchen and pulled out a folded piece of paper. She looked at Jennifer and said, "When you told me you were working on your shame, I Googled the word shame. I found this poem. If you read it, you'll understand me better. Do you want to read it?" Jennifer said she could barely force herself to look at the paper, but she read it. It was Vern Ritsala's poem, Shame. I had never heard of it until Jennifer gave me a copy. I've since shared it with several people, and I do believe it's one of the most courageous acts of truth-telling that I've come across. This is it. "This is the shame of the woman whose hand hides her smile because her teeth are so bad, not the grand self-hate that leads some to razors or pills or swan dives off beautiful bridges, however tragic that is. This is the shame of seeing yourself, of being ashamed of where you live and what your father's paycheck lets you eat and wear. This is the shame of the fat and the bald, the unbearable blush of acne, the shame of having no lunch money and pretending you're not hungry. This is the shame of concealed sickness, diseases too expensive to afford that offer only their cold one-way ticket out. This is the shame of being ashamed, the self-disgust of the cheap wine drunk, the lassitude that makes junk accumulate, the shame that tells you there is another way to live, but you are too dumb to find it. This is the real shame, the damned shame, the crying shame, the shame that's criminal, the shame of knowing words like glory are not in your vocabulary, though they litter the Bibles you're still paying for. This is the shame of not knowing how to read and pretending you do. This is the shame that makes you afraid to leave your house. The shame of food stamps at the supermarket when the clerk shows impatience as you fumble with the change. This is the shame of dirty underwear, the shame of pretending your father works in an office, as God intended all men to do. This is the shame of asking friends to let you off in front of the one nice house in the neighborhood, and waiting in the shadows until they drive away before walking to the gloom of your house. This is the shame at the end of the mania for owing things, the shame of no heat in winter, the shame of eating cat food, the unholy shame of dreaming of a new house and a car, and the shame of knowing how cheap such dreams are." Vern Ritsala. As you can imagine, this marked a huge turning point in Jennifer and Tiffany's friendship. The first few times they were together after this sharing, they both felt a little awkward, which was to be expected. Jennifer said, "At one point, I knew that it would be easier for us to pretend that afternoon didn't happen. But we didn't. It was too big." According to Jennifer, she and Tiffany are best friends today. Jennifer's family is still complicated, but aren't they all? Tiffany and Andy are in couples counseling. Jennifer said that Tiffany threatened to leave if he didn't go, and that would be worse for his image than going to counseling. Tiffany and her mom are working on mending their relationship, and that's been very tough on both of them. Amber didn't run for PTA president again because she decided to become a yoga instructor. Jennifer laughed. She has a huge following. Tiffany and I take her class together. In this next section, we'll look more closely at the concepts of insulating and otherness, two of the barriers that we face when we try to reach out. These are two of the barriers that almost prevented Jennifer and Tiffany from building the connection they now seem to value so deeply. These barriers affect all of the shame resilience elements. If we don't understand how these barriers work in our lives, shame resilience is almost impossible. Let's start by exploring the concept of insulating. Insulating. In a culture of shame, we are constantly overwhelmed with feelings of fear, blame, and disconnection. This creates an us-and-them world. There are people like us, and then there are those other people. And we normally work very hard to insulate ourselves from those people. As children, there were the people that we were allowed to hang out with, and then there were the other kids. There were the people we were allowed to date, and then there were the other kids. There were the schools we went to, and there were schools for the other kids. As adults, we live in the neighborhood where our kind live, and the other neighborhoods are for the other folks. We emotionally and physically insulate ourselves from the other. It never seems to end. We've developed language to describe the others. Sometimes we refer to them as those people, or the even more mysterious, people like that. I seldom use the word truth, because it's a strong word with a lot of promises behind it. But in this instance, I'm going to use it because out of all the things I've learned in the past decade, the one concept that I believe has the biggest potential for helping us overcome shame is this. We are those people. The truth is, we are the others. Most of us are one paycheck, one divorce, one drug-addicted kid, one mental health diagnosis, one serious illness, one sexual assault, one drinking binge, one night of unprotected sex, or one affair away from being those people. The ones we don't trust, the ones we pity, the ones we don't let our children play with, the ones bad things happen to, the ones we don't want living next door. In fact, let me prove my point. If you or your family members have never experienced any one of the following issues, you should just skip the remainder of this chapter. Addiction. Alcohol, drug, food, sex, relationships, etc. Any mental health diagnosis. Depression, anxiety, eating disorders, bipolar, attention deficit, etc. Any stigmatized illness. Sexually transmitted diseases, obesity, HIV/AIDS, etc. Domestic violence, physical, emotional, verbal, etc. Sexual assault, rape, marital rape, date rape, etc. Child abuse, physical, sexual, incest, neglect, emotional, etc. Suicide, violent death, criminal activity or incarceration, serious debt or bankruptcy, abortion, non-mainstream religious beliefs, poverty, including class issues, low educational attainment, lacking basic literacy skills, dropout, etc. Divorce. Okay, statistically, everyone should still be reading. This is the list of otherness, and like it or not, we are on the list. Some of us multiple times. You may read this list and think, she's got to be kidding. Just because I'm divorced doesn't mean people think of me like they think of someone who's gone to jail or someone who's on drugs. Not true. For some people, divorcing may be worse than drug addiction. In fact, I interviewed a woman in her early 60s who told me that she often felt ashamed of her kids. Specifically, the most shame she felt was about her daughter. Her son-in-law caught the daughter having an affair and divorced her. This same woman had a son who spent several months in jail after getting his second DUI at college. She compared the two by saying, "Boys will be boys. I can live with that. But having a trashy daughter is something I'll never get over." The point of this list is not to rank or compare the issues. As I've mentioned before, I don't think that gets us anywhere. It's about understanding that we are all vulnerable to being judged and feeling shame about our experiences. And equally important, we are all vulnerable to judging and shaming others about their experiences. I've interviewed recovering drug addicts who have high levels of resilience about the stigma attached to their addiction. And I've interviewed women who are envied by their friends, but can barely function under the shame of coming from the wrong side of the tracks. Every single one of us is someone else's other. Jennifer and Tiffany are the perfect examples. Jennifer's family history of addiction, Amber's marital history, and the woman who passed out in the carpool line were all others for Tiffany. They were those people. Remember how she told Jennifer, "Carly doesn't look like an alcoholic?" And how she kept repeating how upset she was that the carpool incident happened in our neighborhood and at our school? Tiffany couldn't accept the other in her friends because she denied it so fiercely in her own life. With Andy's encouragement, she tried to pretend that her mother and the poverty she grew up in didn't exist. She had worked so hard to create a world where she could never be perceived as the other that she couldn't accept otherness in Jennifer or Amber. We use the concept of otherness to insulate ourselves and to disconnect. This is why it is such a serious barrier to reaching out as a method of shame resilience. Reaching out in either direction is tough. Practicing courage is as difficult as practicing compassion. They both require us to lean into our discomfort. It was hard for Tiffany to tell Jennifer the truth about her life, and it was also painful for Jennifer to listen. But she forced herself to do it because Tiffany and her relationship with Tiffany were important to her. Sharing our shame with someone is painful, and just sitting with someone who is sharing his or her shame story with us can be equally painful. The natural tendency to avoid or reduce this pain is often why we start to judge and insulate ourselves using otherness. We basically blame them for their experience. We unconsciously divide people into two camps, worthy of our support and unworthy. When someone is feeling shame over one of these otherness issues, we don't feel that compelled to reach out. Likewise, when we are feeling shame because we are experiencing one of these stigmatized issues, it is difficult to reach out for support. It's easier to believe we deserve our shame. The concept of labeling people worthy or unworthy is not new. If you look at the history of charity and philanthropy, going as far back as written history, those needing help have always been separated into the deserving poor or the undeserving poor. This thinking has become part of our culture. You can see it in our public policy, our neighborhoods, and in our families. It plays out on an individual level, exactly like it plays out at the community level. Let's go back to the carpool story. Let's say the woman who was slumped over her steering wheel had suffered a major heart attack and was hospitalized. How many casseroles do you think her family would have received? While she recovered, how many neighborhood moms would have offered to drive her children to and from school? Given the reality that she was passed out drunk in her car in the carpool lane, how many casseroles do you think her family received? If she was admitted into a rehabilitation facility, what's your guess on how many neighborhood moms offered to drive the kids or set up play dates while she was recovering? My guess is not many. The story is very similar for Bette, a woman I interviewed a couple of years ago. Her teenage son committed suicide. Even though she had a large network of friends and colleagues, very few of them attended his funeral. She vacillated from tears to anger, as she told me. "Just 6 months before my son died, my coworker's daughter was killed in a car accident. She was the same age as my son. The funeral was standing room only. You couldn't move. Scott had as many friends as this young girl. He was on the yearbook staff and active in school. I'm as close to my coworkers as this girl's mother. But because Scott committed suicide, no one came." Bette said, "I was so hurt and so furious that I finally asked one of the women at work why so few people came. why only 3 co-workers sent cards. She told me they thought I needed my privacy. They didn't want to make it harder on me. Bet drew a deep breath and said, "Let me tell you what that means. A lot of them think it must somehow be my fault. They didn't know what to say. They didn't want to deal with it. Just too scary. Fear is another reason we insulate. As my husband, Steve, read through this other list, he shook his head and said, "Yep, these are the issues that we judge and blame people for." Then he thought for a minute and asked, "What about those issues that we don't really blame people for, but scare us and send us running in the other direction?" I knew exactly what he meant. Sometimes we don't turn away from people because their experiences are so stigmatized and socially unacceptable, but simply because they're too scary. My story about the NICU is a good example. I first became aware of my own fear-based insulating when my husband was in his residency. Steve was spending the month in the neonatal intensive care unit, NICU. On the nights he came home, he would tell me stories from the NICU. I found the courage to listen, only because I knew he needed a safe place to process his grief and celebrate his successes. After a couple of weeks of stories about dangerous deliveries, dying babies, and grieving families, I became less empathic and more freaked out. It didn't help that I was 6 months pregnant with my first baby. I started asking him questions about each family, mostly questions about their race, income, and medical history. Fearing I would seem insensitive, I would disguise the questions as concern and interest. "I want to picture them. Do they look like anyone we know? Are they our age? It must be expensive. Do they have insurance? Is there a medical reason this happened?" One day, sensing Steve's frustration with my litany of bullshit questions, I did away with the niceties and cut straight to demographics. "What race? Poor? Drug users? Prenatal care? Genetic problems?" Steve looked at me and said, "No, Brené, they look just like us. This happens to all types of people, even people just like us." I started crying. "No, it can't." I didn't want to believe it. I wanted to use every existing system of difference to separate me from those people, and if by some strange chance they matched us on all the descriptors, I would move to the next step. "Well then, what did they do wrong?" After Steve confronted me about my efforts to separate myself from those people in the NICU, I realized that I often rely on that technique when I watch the evening news. If I'm in the kitchen, cooking and listening to the news on the TV in the living room, and a horrible story about rape, murder, or child abduction comes on, I often fly into the living room, whisk in hand, to see what the victim looks like and where it happened. The second I spot someone different from me, or a neighborhood far from mine, I feel a little less fearful. One day, when I was discussing sexual assault with my students, we started talking about how often victims of sexual assault are re-victimized during court proceedings. I told the students, "The defense attorneys don't want the jurors to relate to the victim, what she looks like, her age, her race, where she was when the assault happened, etc. Fearing the jurors may relate to her, the defense attorneys attack her character so that no one would want to relate to her." I continued, "I'm sure that's easy to do. I wouldn't want to relate to her, because that would mean it could happen to me too." As the discussion progressed, I shared how much I rely on this technique to protect myself. One by one, the students acknowledged doing the same thing, sharing their own stories of how and when they insulated themselves in the face of fear. While sitting in a classroom, it is easy to be outraged about sexual assault survivors, even children, being blamed and ostracized when they are abused. Yet the practice of separating ourselves from others is something most of us do on a daily basis. Unfortunately, as we recognized in finding ourselves on the otherness list, most of us will experience a loss or trauma that others will find difficult and scary. If we've spent our lives continually insulating ourselves from the people who are suffering and surviving great losses, what happens when something happens to us? I think most of us turn on ourselves. What did I do to deserve this? Why me? This happened because I did something bad or wrong. Once we've convinced ourselves that things like this don't happen to people like me, then when it does happen, it means we've done something terribly wrong. We've been kicked out of the group that kept us safe, that mythical group that always escapes tragedy. That's why people who survive cancer, women who survive sexual assault, adults who were once homeless, parents who have lost children, and families who have been affected by acts of violence often tell me two things. Before it happened, I never believed it could happen to me. It only happened to other people, and you never know. It can happen to anyone. I just want to be there for others who are going through the same thing. It's hard. We don't want to connect with people who are in pain, especially if we believe they deserve their pain, or if their pain is too scary for us. We don't want to reach out. It feels risky. Just by associating with them, we could either end up in the same other pile, or be forced to acknowledge that bad things happen to people like us. I hear the same thing again and again from the women who are willing to connect. It's not easy. The women who take the casseroles when people are gossiping and judging, or the women who walk through their own fear to comfort someone else, aren't superheroes. They are ordinary women who sometimes have to force themselves to do it. It doesn't always come naturally, but they all say it gets easier with practice. My mom is one of those women. I have very vivid memories of my mom being the one sitting next to the neighbor who was in crisis. Not just the acceptable crises, either. I grew up in the suburbs. Trust me, there were some very traumatic events that didn't fit that cookie-cutter life that we were all supposed to be living. I even remember being embarrassed sometimes because my mother was the one taking the casserole to the person who everyone was talking about, or she would invite the family who was swirling in horrible rumors to our house for dinner. I didn't understand it then, but now I get it. My mom grew up with several boxes checked on the other list. As I noted earlier, my grandmother was an alcoholic. She was an incredibly generous and compassionate person who struggled for years with addiction. Back then, alcoholism was misunderstood and a source of even more shame than it is today, especially for women. On top of that, my grandparents divorced when my mom was in the third grade. My mom has talked openly to us about the difficulty of reconciling her life with the social community expectations that defined the 1950s. However, somewhere along the line, she found the courage to talk openly about her experiences. By doing this, she realized that she was not alone in this struggle and made the decision to get out from under the shame that was heaped on her by the Ozzy and Harriet culture and its followers. In doing so, she charted a new course for my siblings and me. Even now, as I get older, and the hard things seem to be happening to the people around me more often, I sometimes still struggle. And predictably, I call my mom. She still tells my brother, my sisters, and me the same thing every time. You just go to the funeral. You just take the casserole when the neighbors are gossiping and peeking out of their blinds. Put yourself in a trance if you need to, but get in the car and drive over there. Write down exactly what you want to say, but pick up the phone and make the call. I think the most important thing she has told me about reaching out to others in crisis is this. You do it because that's the person you want to be. You do it because that could have been me, and one day it could just as easily be you. Your connection network. If we want to develop shame resilience, we must learn how to reach out. We must take what we know about courage, compassion, and connection and put it into practice. It's not easy to ask someone to listen, and it's not easy to be the one who listens. In the workshops, I have participants look at their shame triggers and try to identify the people with whom they can reach out. It's important to realize that often the person we can turn to regarding one issue is not the best person to talk to about other issues. For example, Susan's sister, from the introduction, made a shaming comment about Susan's putting her child in Mother's Day out. Susan said, "When it comes to parenting, my mom and my sister are definitely in my shame web. But when it comes to